This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hugo, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Gone with the Wind almost didn't include Gable's now classic exit line. The Hollywood censors wanted to change it to, "My dear, I don't care." But the film's producer made a deal to tone down other scenes in exchange for keeping the curtain closer. From 1930 to 1968, the Motion Picture Production Code ruled over sexuality, violence, costumes, the use of the flag, obscenity, profanity, and anything in a movie that could be construed as lowering the moral standards of viewers. The censors had to approve Mae West's double entendres and Jane Russell's cleavage. Homosexuality was forbidden. The code was adopted in 1930 by the Association of Motion Picture Producers. The director was Will Hayes, and although the censors' headquarters were known as the Hayes Office, during most of the code's history, it was Joe Breen who was the code's enforcer. The code was replaced in 1968 by the system that now rates films G, PG, R, or X. My guest Leonard Leff is the author of a new history of Hollywood censorship and the production code called The Dame in the Kimono. It's co-authored with Gerald Simmons. Leff teaches film history and screenwriting at Oklahoma State University. I asked Leonard Leff why he wanted to research the history of the production code.
My collaborator and I were very interested in the production code as early as the 1970s when we began to look closely at the history of cinema. If you want a real answer, I guess the answer goes back to my childhood when my brother and I used to cut up and my father would raise his finger and say, the Hayes office, you'd better be careful. And I would say, what the devil is the Hayes office? And that would be all he would say. So I was sort of curious from the age of 10 forward.
Now, you say that Hollywood created self-censorship and the production code to prevent outside censorship. One of the organizations they were afraid of was the church, who was who opposed the morality of the movies of the time. What was the church doing to organize against the scenes and the lines and the sexuality that they didn't like in movies?
What eventually became the Legion of Decency began as a grassroots movement in various parts of the Midwest, Indianapolis, Chicago, where various church officials in these towns decided that they would advise parishioners on films that they should and particularly should not see. Eventually, this became a national Legion of Decency, which meant that there was national attention through the Catholic press on these films which the church felt were inappropriate for parishioners. These films were rated, much as we rate films today, the equivalent of X, and only in terms of the harshest rating you could get, was the so-called C for condemned. And these were pictures that the parishioners were enjoined from seeing.
Now, the movie industry was also concerned about state censorship boards, and the censorship codes were very erratic from state to state. Give us some examples of what you could do in one state and couldn't do in another.
Well, in some states, pregnant women could not be shown on screen. In other states, women smoking could not be shown on screen. Each state board seemed to have its own ideas on violence, and what made this so difficult for Hollywood was that a number of state boards, for example, that in Kansas, did not have its rules written down. There were three or four women who met in the Kansas City Fire Department to look at films, and whenever something offended them or crossed the line that they seemed to know in their minds, they rang the bell and the scene was censored, and Kansans could not see it.
Now, the Hollywood Production Code was adapted from a 1929 code by Martin Quigley, who was the publisher of the Motion Picture Herald, and you say a devout Catholic. That code that he created had three principles. One is that you couldn't lower moral standards of viewers, divine and natural laws couldn't be belittled, and false values shouldn't be placed in the minds of youth. Now, you say that when Hayes adapted this code, he never mentioned its Catholic roots, its church roots.
That's right. And there were various reasons for this. I think that the whole matter of censorship of films was a sensitive one for Hollywood, and probably in part what Hayes figured was the less said about censorship, the better. But Hayes in particular did not want the public feeling that a Catholic censorship had been imposed on the movies. And this was one of the reasons that he kept the origins of the code, as well as for a period of time, the authors of the code, their names secret.
Leonard Leff is my guest. He's the co-author of the new book, The Dame in the Kimono, Hollywood Censorship and the Production Code from the 1920s to the 1960s. Now, let's talk a little bit about what was going on in the movies in the 1930s when the code was actually adopted. Most of the violence, I suppose, was in the gangster films of the period. How did they play once the code came into effect?
Well, the gangster films were cleaned up in a variety of ways. What the people who ran the code office were most afraid of, and they were afraid of it because of the local and state municipal censors, what they were afraid of was showing the criminals in a light that would make them seem sympathetic characters or make them appeal to young people. And so what you actually had toward the mid-30s, when the production code finally got teeth, were a series of films in which actors like Cagney and Bogart, rather than playing criminals, were in fact playing law enforcement officers, G-men. Part of the reason for that, I think, was that it simply wasn't as easy to make gangster films anymore once you lost the luster and the glamour of the gangster.
Well, didn't the code even make it illegal for a character to shoot a cop?
It did. It did. And this was a law that stood for a number of years. In fact, only when we get to the mid-1950s do we see a kind of crack in the wall on that issue.
Well, one of the important films in your case studies of films that were affected by the code and films that had an effect on the code, one of those films is Gone with the Wind, the 1939 movie. There were 50 pages of notes from the Hays office on this film. They wanted the pain of childbirth muted, which I thought was very interesting. I mean, to think that a woman going through a painful childbirth would somehow be offensive. Can you explain the logic behind that?
It's difficult to explain the logic behind a lot of these various idiosyncrasies of the code. Most of them have their origins in the state and municipal censorship laws. This is where the code came from. But in general, there was a feeling that you could not be too graphic, too realistic, too explicit on screen when it came to pain of any sort, and childbirth was one. There was a scene in Wild Boys of the Road, a mid-1930s Warner Brothers epic, in which a character is run over by a train and loses his leg. And there was considerable dialogue within Warner Brothers itself, not simply between Warner Brothers and the code office, about how that was to be treated, because there was a fear that if you showed it too realistically, you would have miscarriages in the theater. And this is exactly what the memoranda say. There is a concern that of that nature.
Now, another thing about Gone with the Wind, the Hays office wanted any suggestions of rape taken out of the ravishment scene. The producer of Gone with the Wind was David O. Selznick, and his representative on censorship issues was Val Lewton. Now, this is very ironic, because Val Lewton was the producer of I Walked with a Zombie, Curse of the Cat People, The Body Snatcher. I mean, these are movies that are about, like, the deepest, most secret kind of sexual longings and fears, you know? So to have him be the censorship representative is fascinating. But anyway, so Val Lewton is on the set with the director of Gone with the Wind, Victor Fleming, making sure that Fleming directs the ravishment scene in an appropriate way. What was he exactly looking out for?
Well, I think that, again, nothing could be shown too explicitly. The production code was not so absolute. This was one of the interesting things that we found. Not so absolute as many of the popular histories of Hollywood make out. Joe Breen, the head of the production code office, was generally willing to work with filmmakers to treat almost any subject, but the operative word was treat. You could not be too explicit. You could not be too direct. So this scene where Rhett was exercising a blatant, forceful, animal-like sexuality could be treated, but it had to be treated circumspectly. As you know from reading the book, one of the questions that came up about Gone with the Wind in this particular scene was, where and when do we fade out? Joe Breen always felt that the fade was important, because if you faded out at certain points, You suggested certain things. If you faded out too slowly, you suggested others, and so forth and so on. This also, incidentally, says something about the audiences of the time, which were very adept at reading films. Part of the problem for Breen with the so-called husbandly rape scene was the follow-up scene as well. Once you faded out on Rhett taking Scarlett up the stairs, what did you fade back into? And part of the problem for Breen was the expression on Scarlett's face, which suggested that she had enjoyed the so-called husbandly rape a little more than she should have.
Well, was she supposed to resist or not?
She was supposed to resist up to a point, and she was supposed to have enjoyed it the following morning up to a point.
Now, how was the code enforced? I mean, the way you describe it, it was really based on the fact that the Hollywood studios also owned the movie chains.
That's right. And if you did not have the production code seal from Joe Breen, the head of the production code office, you could not play the most profitable theaters in America. So clearly, there was impetus to get that production code seal, and it was foregone that you would. No studio was going to release a picture without the seal, not only because it couldn't play the theaters, but because it could not play army bases and other places like that.
The serious challenges to the production code happened after World War II. You say one of the first challenges really was from the Italian neorealists like Visconti, De Sica, Rossellini. Their movies included things that you couldn't do in American films, but their films played in art theaters. And were the art theaters exempt from having to book movies with the production code seal?
Yes, they were.
Why?
Well, a theater could or could not play movies without the seal. But if a theater belonged to a chain, and the chain belonged to the Motion Picture Association, it had pledged not to play films without the seal. So these were essentially independent theaters.
Is this the way that foreign films got the reputation for being racier than American films?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Now, in the late 40s, there was a lawsuit that forced the studios to give up the theater chains that they owned. How did that change how the code was enforced?
Well, shortly thereafter, and incidentally, the so-called divorcement decree came in 1948, but in fact, the divorcement of the theaters and the distribution arm of the studios and the studios themselves did not occur finally until 10 years later. But over that 10-year period from 1948 to 1958, we saw a steady erosion of the compulsion of theaters to show only those films which had the seal. In other words, theaters were separated from the studios. They could go their own way. They could show the films that they chose. And for us, Bicycle Thief was a very important film because for the first time, a number of theaters that formerly were affiliated with the studios, and in some cases actually still were, decided to show this film. And again, I would like to say that the theater owners saw that there was something special, something artistic about Bicycle Thief. But in fact, what they saw was, here was a film getting a tremendous amount of press. Perhaps there are some dollars in it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you described A Streetcar Named Desire as one of the movies that created a crack in the production code. This was in part, I think, because Elia Kazan refused to take out the rape scene. What effect did that have on the code, his resistance?
With Bicycle Thief in 1949, Joe Breen realized that he really could not hold the line that he had held for the last 15 years, and the picture Streetcar Named Desire showed just how Breen began to adapt himself to the new wave of pictures that came in America in the 1950s in the wake of the European films of the post-1940s. Streetcar Named Desire was one of any number of films which everyone in Hollywood said could not be made or could not be made as it was originally written. And indeed, there were a number of elements of Streetcar Named Desire which had to be eliminated from the film script that were contained in the play. For example, Blanche's husband and the references, the oblique references even in the play to his homosexuality were removed. Blanche's nymphomania or whatever it may have been. There were references in the play, allusions in the play to that. They were removed. But Elia Kazan and Tennessee Williams, and for that matter their producer, drew the line over the rape. It was too vital a part of the story to be eliminated. And Joe Breen said that, yes, finally, you may film the rape as long as you film it in such a way that the adults will understand what's going on, but the children will not quite follow. And so we indeed do have the rape scene in A Streetcar Named Desire, and that is a turning point for Hollywood.
So would you describe how that scene is enacted now so that the children don't get it, but the adults do?
Well, it's rather interesting because after Joe Breen had approved the picture, the Catholic Legion of Decency came in and made a number of further cuts, or at any rate suggested a number of cuts, which the producers were forced to make. And so the scene as we see it in the film today is not quite the scene as Joe Breen approved it. As a matter of fact, it is a bit more muted than he approved it. For example, there was a line that Stanley has, you know, he says to Blanche, you might not be too bad to interfere with. And that was a line that the church wanted out of the picture. So what we have is Stanley closing in on Blanche. We have the breaking of a bottle, the shattering of a bottle, and then we have a fade out. And then you may remember we come up on that fire plug, which is disgorging water, a kind of standard symbol for sexuality from the earliest days in Hollywood.
Kind of like the train going through the tunnel.
Yes.
There are great codes that everybody came up with, so everybody got the message through through symbolism.
Well, that was the interesting thing, and the question that we have been asked by friends who have read the book is, do you think, in fact, that the films were somehow better or not as good during the era of the code? And I don't know that we can really answer that. We are left with films as they are, and it's difficult to imagine how they might have been. Our suspicion is that the directors who were inventive and original were simply forced to be more inventive and more original during the code era.
Well, I know that that's one theory, that movies got more inventive because they had to circumvent the code. On the other hand, there were all kinds of characters who could never be represented and all kinds of thoughts that could never truly be given a voice in the American movies.
That's true. And I think a good example of that is homosexuality, drug addiction. These were interdictions that appeared in the code from the beginning. And for that matter, divorced women were a problem for Joe Breen, who himself was a Catholic and who came down very hard on pictures that painted a fairly happy picture of a contented divorced woman.
The code was rewritten in 1956. How has it changed?
It was changed in a variety of ways. Narcotics could finally be treated. There were a number of other subjects that could be treated as well in 1956, but narcotics was the principal one. And the film that was a kind of breakthrough film was Man with a Golden Arm, which today, up against Drugstore Cowboy and a couple of other films we have out now, looks tame, but in its time had a certain amount of power. Another example is the film A Hat Full of Rain, which was also about narcotics abuse.
So these films couldn't have been made before.
That's true.
Virginia Woolf, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? This is another film that you list as a breakthrough film. Was it because of the language of the film?
Yes, it was essentially because of the language. There were words in that film which probably would pollute the fresh air microphone, so we won't even mention what they are. But
that's right. There's plenty of words we can't say on radio, although you can say them now in movies.
That's right. Yeah, and this was essentially a question of language, but it was also a question of volume, the sheer number of 4, 6, and other letter words which were used in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Up to that time, it had been an occasional word, but here you were dealing with a torrent of profanity and blasphemy.
Well, I thought it was interesting. The writer of the screen adaptation tried to get around the code by writing things like "for cry's sake," C-R-Y, and "goddamn," G-A-H-damn. I guess that didn't pass, huh?
It didn't pass with Mike Nichols, and here is one of the principal
factors. He was the director of the film.
That's right. Mike Nichols was the director of the film. Ernest Lehman, the screenwriter and the producer, both of them felt that these were watered-down versions of Albee's very strong dialogue. they had an internal dialogue which lasted over a number of months with Jack Warner, who was skittish about the language of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But finally, it was Mike Nichols' power as a director which carried the day. This could not have happened really even 10 years before, certainly not 20 years before. But by 1965, the directors had essentially taken over the studios.
Do you think that self-censorship served a positive role in Hollywood? Going back, you know, to the beginning of our interview, you said that that Hollywood adopted a code rather than caving into outside censorship, and also that they decided to follow the ratings code, the PGRX, in order to prevent outside censorship. Do you think it was successful in doing that, and do you think that it was any better than the outside censorship would have been?
As a matter of fact, we think that it was more harsh than outside censorship would have been. It was also more long-lived than outside censorship would have been. Had the censorship been legal rather than voluntary, had it been legal censorship rather than a self-regulatory body, there would have been constitutional tests, and I think the laws would have been put aside, and the movies would have had an easier time of it. But Hollywood persisted. Hollywood wanted to regulate itself, and by darn, it did.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with us about censorship in the movies. And my guest has been Leonard Leff. His new book on the production cult is called The Dame in the Kimono. It's co-authored with Gerald Simmons. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.